Hello, and welcome to this evening's webinar. This is Chantelle Cecile Cura, and I'm moderating a webinar this evening for MomsFightingAutism.com. And I'm honored this evening to have Dr. Patrick Schwarz as my guest. He's a professor and author, a motivational speaker, and a leader in education in various areas of education, including inclusive education, special education, and general education, as well as educational leadership. He is a professor at the Diversity in Learning and Teaching Department National Lewis University in Chicago, and the author or co-author of various books, including From Disability to Possibility, The Power of Inclusive Classrooms. That's his book. You're Welcome, 30 Innovative Ideas for the Inclusive Classroom, which he co-wrote with Dr. Paula Kluth. And also, Just Give Him the Whale is a book that he has written. Is that your book, or did you write that with somebody?
I also wrote that with Paula Kluth.
Okay.
Hi, everyone.
And I'm going to ask you to speak a little bit more about that in a minute. And I also understand you have another book called Pedro's Whale that'll be coming out. And also, before we get to talking about these books, would you like to give your website address for those who would like to know more about you or read up on those books?
Sure. It's patrickschwarz.com, and I'll spell Patrick Schwarz. Patrick is P-A-T-R-I-C-K, and Schwarz, I will spell more slowly. It's S-C-H-W-A-R-Z.
Thank you, Dr. Schwarz. Am I saying your name correctly?
You are.
Okay, because, you know, with the name that I have, Chantelle Cecile Cura, I should be able to pronounce your name very easily, but you know how that goes. Okay, so before we get started on talking more about you, I did want to touch on two of your books, the first one being Just Give Him the Whale, and then I would, if you could tell us a little bit about that book, and then also I would like to hear about your next upcoming book, which is Pedro's Whale.
Sure. First of all, Just Give Him the Whale came from a real-life story that happened in a Chicago public school, and it evolved around a young man named Pedro. And Pedro is a person that is identified as having autism as an attribute. And the reason I say autism is an attribute is I feel there are a lot of things that make up every individual as a human being. Autism may be one of those things, but you can find any individual having lots of things that make them the person they are. So, for example, Pedro liked whales a lot. He liked the computer a lot. He liked certain foods a lot. He liked activity a lot. And when the kids in kindergarten met him, they found out he's more like them than different from them. So Just Give Him the Whale, the story comes from Pedro's interest in whales. So what happened is Pedro at kindergarten would carry a whale picture, and he would use the picture to support himself when he was at his desk. So he would put it out on the desk, and one day he was doing math in class. And rather than doing math, he was playing with the whale photo, and the teacher saw him doing this, and she said, "Pedro, right now we're not doing whales, we're doing math. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put your whale picture on the choice table, and when you finish your math, you can choose to do your whale picture or anything else that you want." And what happened is Pedro went under the table, and he wouldn't get out. So the principal was called down to the classroom, and the teacher told the story to the principal, and she said, "I got to let you know something." She said, "I carry photos of my two daughters in my purse, and I'm one of those individuals that will get the photos out when we're talking about children, and I would be sad if somebody took those photos away from him." And she said, "Could Pedro's whale picture and whales help support him to work in math and finish his work?" And she said, "Let's think about it." And she said, "Just give him the whale." And the teacher, who was a conscientious teacher, went home that evening, and she made a couple of changes fairly quickly. The first thing she did is on Pedro's blocks that he was using to count, she put pictures of whales on them. And that way, Pedro had his whales surrounding him. He had many pictures of whales, and all of a sudden he's fighting to count blocks. The other thing she did is she got a self-inking stamp of a whale, and when Pedro would finish his work, she would put that on the paper, and Pedro all of a sudden is wanting to finish his work. So the whale became a support system. And I think what the belief has tended to be in the field is saying that if there's a student with autism who really likes something a lot, people will tend to say they're obsessed with that particular thing. And we looked at this very carefully in the book, and we actually did some research with students, and we turned the whole thing around. So rather than taking away the passions, how can we use them to support the particular individual? And this example was a very good example. We're excited about that book. The Just Give Him the Whale is actually for educators. It's for families and all the members of school teams to help support individuals in school and beyond. We're excited about the book because the cover artist, his name is Justin Canha, and he's actually a young man with autism as an attribute, and he's a high school student in New Jersey, and he's getting famous for his artistic ability, not just as an individual with autism, just because he's a great artist. And he has a New York gallery that represents him, and he was just in Chicago Now art exhibit, which had all sorts of famous artists, and Justin's work was there. And so we're really proud to have him do the artwork. The Pedro's Whale will be the next book coming out, and it's a children's book. And the exciting thing is Justin Canha did all the artwork for that particular children's book, and we made him an equal partner because we think since he publishes work in Oprah's magazine and things such as that, that he is definitely got a famous audience to bring forward for this book. So we thought that was an important thing to do. Also, there was an important kid's story in this story about Pedro. What happened is when the teacher supported Pedro well with his whales, the students followed suit. They started bringing whale things in. They brought in whale pictures. They brought in whale-stuffed animals and books, and they asked if they could go to the aquarium for the field trip. So we thought, wow, they're being good friends to Pedro, and we wanted to tell that story for kids in the children's book. So we're really excited to have that coming out in the spring. That's the story of Just Give Him the Whale and Pedro's Whale.
That's really great. Thank you for sharing that with us. It kind of, I'm thinking back to my son, you know, who's in high school and who is included. And it's interesting, out in public and in the school area, he usually always wants to carry something. It doesn't have to be a particular object like representation of a whale as it is for Pedro. But it just reminded me, and you made a really excellent point, in one way you're using an object or something that he really likes, but on the other hand, sometimes whatever that object is, it helps that person feel secure. It's
exactly.
Not just something he likes and he's interested in, but it's a great example of how you use whatever is you taking that child's interest or making him feel secure and using it to help him.
Right. We found that it serves so many purposes, making students secure, helping them to communicate, helping them to understand learning concepts, helping them to branch out in things they're able to do. And we haven't found a passion or interest yet that we couldn't find some way of supporting the individual. And there have been some interesting ones, such as levers and cockroaches and things such as that. But, you know, with things such as that, we got, with the levers, we got a student involved in the physics club, the cockroaches. In terms of the student being involved with biology and zoology, things such as that. So
right.
It's all about looking at some point in life we specialize, and can we provide those supports throughout a person's life to help them learn.
Right. Now, we have so many questions here that people have written in, but I really wanted to ask you to begin with, why or how did you get interested in this field, in inclusion? And my goodness, all the parts of education that you're interested in, of course, they all work together because you have to have some idea about special education to be and general education to be able to work on the inclusive education bit. But why this field for you?
First of all, I grew up next door to a young man with Down syndrome, and my bedroom bordered on their house, and his name was David. And David always went to a different school than I went to. We lived one house away from a park, and he typically was not at the park. And one of the things that I found out that my mom shared is David's parents had passed away, and he went into more of an institutional type of setting when he became older, and he passed away alone in that institutional setting, and I never felt that was a good thing, and it always bothered me. And that was kind of the start of a few things. There are also some individuals that have various support needs that are relatives in my family. Have one relative who has some bipolar support needs. I have another relative who's been labeled as schizophrenic. And furthermore, what happened is I took a course at University of Wisconsin in Madison where I was doing my undergrad, and some people told me, oh, there's this professor, Lou Brown, and you take this course. It's called Introduction to People with Intellectual Disabilities, and you don't have to take exams, but you have to work in institutions and schools. And I thought, okay, I'll do that. And so I took that course, and what they did is he was trying to weed out people for his teacher training program, and I was called up at the end. He just called up a few names, and he said, I want you to be in my teacher training program. Well, actually, I went into school thinking I was going to be an occupational therapist, but couldn't take courses for that until I was a junior. So he said, well, how about this? I will give you an independent study. And that sounded really good for being a sophomore. And so I did it, and it was in a great school, and I absolutely fell in love with it. I actually worked with Ann Donnellan after that, who was an autism leader.
Yes, so I know Ann Donnellan very well. She's now located in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes.
She's my Facebook friend now, and it's just an honor because she said she's using my books for her courses, and I felt like, wow, that's awesome that your professor did that.
Very happy that she's here in Southern California now.
And I got to tell you, too, is when I taught in Madison Public Schools, I taught for 9 years, and a number of my students were identified as having autism as an attribute. And those were in the days that autism was one in every 10,000 births, different than the latest figure, one in every 91 births. And so it was really a heyday and kind of a landmark experience to have this for the last few decades, the last couple of decades, and it's just an honor to be in the field and continue to work with it evolving.
Now, let me ask you a question. Do you believe that an inclusive education is the right thing for all students?
I do. Here's my reason why. Is what happens is consider students who are in school on a time clock. So when you're receiving mandated school services, you're getting the free appropriate public mandated education. And that runs out somewhere between 18 and 21. And then people go into a different world, and it's called the world of discretionary services. And families at that point, individuals and their families, do not have the mandated services. And here's my belief is also part of when the individual gets done with school is we have to make it with everybody in the world at that point. And I haven't heard in any community in the country that there's a self-contained Walmart. So I believe that anything we do to make the definition of inclusion, which I consider everybody belongs with everybody in our school and community, come alive, I think you're doing the individual a service for the future. I'm extremely alarmed by the outcome of current special education services, which is 75% of people with disabilities are unemployed. I will say that again, 75% of people with disabilities are unemployed. And some people might peg that on the fact that we have an awful economy right now, but this was before the awful economy. And I got to say something, is it's actually going up rather than being addressed at this point.
You're absolutely correct. Those figures actually were out in a report, I think it was 2002, and they mm-hmm. said those figures of the, can't remember if it was 72% or 78%, but those figures were true for the past 12 years, and only because they'd been taking data for the past 12 years. And so, in fact, that is part of the reasons why they strengthened IDEA when it was reauthorized. But you bring up a really great point, is that, A, we're not preparing our students in the right way, we're not preparing the community in the right way, but if you have them in two separate areas, how do you expect them to then know about each other and understand and support each other if they're being raised separately, and then all of a sudden you want to put somebody in an environment where supposedly supposed to be able to function and people are supposed to have an understanding?
Exactly, and I actually did my dissertation on this, and what I did is I decided to try to uncover what is the reason we have that horrible unemployment rate. And so what I did is I started out going to individuals who were adults with disabilities who were unemployed, and I just asked a very basic question, do you want to have a job? 99.7% said they absolutely wanted to have a job. So it wasn't their desire. The second thing is I asked the same individuals, when you were in school, did you have any kind of vocational work study, employment, job type of training? And it was just almost as high, it was in the 90%, people said they had job training. Now, we might question the quality of that training if people are unemployed, but I felt there was something else taking place. And I did some further research, and it actually went to my own experiences. I will introduce myself to people and say, hi, I'm Patrick Shores. I'm in the field of special education. And people say things such as, you must be so patient. I couldn't do that. You're a saint before your own time. There's a special place for you above, you know, things such as that. And I tended to kind of think, whoa, you know, you'd laugh at first at some of those things. But what I tell people in the end is, you know what? No, you just got to like people. And when you get to know somebody who may get around differently, communicate differently, look differently, or look just like you, but maybe learn differently, is you'll find out once you get to know them, they're more like you than different from you. And here's the scary part of that. The people who are making the statements are potential employers, coworkers, neighbors, and friends. And the reason that I feel we have that horrible unemployment rate is because of our general population. It doesn't have to do with the desire of people with disabilities or necessarily their training. It's because we've segregated our general population away from people who have disabilities.
Yes, well, actually also, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but I do quite a lot of work on this area of work because from a personal, it came from a personal reason because having my son who's 20, and also because of my past experience years ago, I worked with young adults in an institution with the first wave of students in California that were going to be deinstitutionalized and live in the community. And so the surprising thing is that even though I feel that things have changed a lot in the field of work and employment, I somehow see in many areas that we're still just showing or training people for certain jobs. It's always the same type of jobs.
Right, food service, maintenance.
Yes, you know, stocking shelves, sweeping, wiping tables. And I'm not saying that, you know, I'm sure there are people out there who want to do those jobs, and that's great. But there aren't enough of those jobs for everybody. And
right.
I think it's really important, as you say, just like the story about just give him the whale, look at the whale. What are the whales that this person has, and how can he make money from it? That's
right,
the bottom
exactly.
line.
And sometimes those interests change over time, too. So Pedro actually likes dinosaurs a lot now. And that's okay because we continue to grow and change. And also, too, just to kind of conclude the whole employment thing, is my belief is successful school inclusion leads to a much greater chance of successful adult community inclusion. And it's just as important for our general population as it is for an individual that has autism.
Right. I agree with you. So we're going to start now with some questions. How do you feel about that?
That's fine. Bring it on.
Okay. So here's a question, and I'm sorry if I'm massacring anybody's name out there, but I'm going to try my best. Andrea Herndon in Burlington. And her question is, how will the parents and teachers know when the time is right for inclusion? What signs do you look for, or what signs do you need?
I actually have this belief is it's never too early, it's never too late to start. And so actually the definition with inclusion is you don't need prerequisites to be able to successfully support someone. And probably my best example of this is a young man named Jason. And I met Jason when he was in his kindergarten year. And he was coming to a school that I was supporting for his first grade year, but I saw him the year before, and I went on a visit with the principal of the new school and the pupil services director of the new school district who was going to have him the following year. And when we saw Jason, he was in a self-contained classroom for individuals who were identified with autism and pervasive developmental challenges. And he was running around with a big stick. He was making noise, and they were giving him goldfish cracker reinforcers every few minutes. And I'm trying to figure out, what are they trying to reinforce here? And so just to add to the following year, in terms of the school that he was going to be going to, it was an inclusive school, and he was going to be attending in general education environments, and it was an open school. And that's the way that they provided those services. And so with Jason, he started to try to do those things the following year. And he ran around, he made noise, he actually was looking for food, and he visited every single area in the school that first day. And so there was the emergency faculty meeting called, and I was on. And so I said, hi, everybody. I know you've all met Jason today. And they kind of had these interesting looks on their faces. And I said, most of you think Jason is a student with a behavior challenge. And they kind of all had interesting looks on their faces again. And I said, actually, something that you should know about Jason is he's an individual with autism as an attribute, and something that we know about many individuals that have autism, and also there are a lot of people who don't have a disability who have this as well, is they may not necessarily like a lot of change at once. And if you look at Jason's life, he's had a brand new school. All of you are new to him. All of the students are new to him. He lives in a new home. He has a new neighborhood. There are new streets. And he couldn't possibly have more change. And so if you're thinking about Jason, I decided to start a strategy. So the following day, what we did is he delivered mail to everybody's classroom. So I just made it okay that he was in every area of the school. And he would bring mail back to to the main office. Now, I didn't want that to be a permanent thing, but we had to start somewhere. So I was thinking big, but starting small. And actually, in his general education classroom, every period is he was in each class every period for a certain amount of time, but we were getting to know him in terms of a learner, in terms of his communication, in terms of his choice and control and things such as that. And so it was a step-by-step process. And what it comprised of is gradually fading out some of that delivery and increasing the amount of time in general education. And some really wonderful things happened to him. He gained some really nice communication skills. He gained literacy skills. He was actually honor student of the month and had lunch with the superintendent 1 month. And when he graduated from that elementary school, he walked across the stage. He didn't run across the stage. And I think what he taught the teachers of that school is what they were saying is they were saying inclusion wasn't easier, but it was better. And look what happened with Jason. So we could have tried to make Jason from day one sit in a chair and expect him to do all these things. It wouldn't have worked. I think we would have had a much bigger young man running around making noise, looking for food. So my belief is that you create a support plan around the learner in around Jason and what his needs were, and you keep taking steps. And that's kind of a story that I think frames that question well.
I think it's important also to mention that inclusion doesn't mean that you're just sticking somebody in the mainstream classroom.
Right. I actually had to testify a few years ago for reauthorization of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, so IDEA. And there was a person testifying against me. There were panels. And it was Al Shanker, who's now deceased, but he was the head of the American Federation of Teachers at the time. And one of the statements he made, he said, they're dumping students with Down syndrome in New York public schools. And I said, respectfully, Mr. Shanker, is that wouldn't be my definition of inclusion, is you're not taking services away from a student. What you're doing is you are still giving them their services. You're redefining how you're giving them to them, and they're receiving them in different environments other than separate environments.
Right. So I'm going to now take this opportunity to ask a question that someone sent in on this topic.
Okay.
I think it's a very valid question because many times as parents, we don't know, you know, how inclusion can be done. We aren't told by our school districts often. Here's a question from Sandra Lerman in Wyandotte.
Okay.
Why does everyone think that inclusion is the answer? The idea of having my autistic child in a classroom with 35 other children and a teacher who has no idea how to teach an autistic child does not seem like the right way to go. When I hear inclusion, I immediately think of the government trying to save money by not having to pay for the expertise of an educated, experienced teacher.
Right. I think that's kind of the same mindset that Mr. Shanker was operating from, is that it would be a money-saving type of proposition. And there may be some places that are treating it that way. So I can see the definite reason for that question. And what I would say is that would definitely not be my definition of inclusion. It's a support plan. We're not taking services away from the individual, as I feel that the individual still receives special education services. And sometimes the special education teacher has a redefined name as an inclusion facilitator. And always special education should operate as a team process. So there would be, first of all, the members of the team would be the student's family, a general education teacher, a special education teacher, and other personnel depending on that individual's related services. And if they have any paraeducator services. Those would be all individuals of a team, so it's a team process. And if somebody's doing it to save money, that wouldn't be my definition of inclusion being a support plan and a support process around the learner. I think that is just a different model trying to save money. And it's sad that inclusion gets connotated with that because that wouldn't be part of my definition.
Right. Thank you so much for clarifying that, because it is something that comes up all the time. Okay. We have so many more questions here.
Okay.
This one's from Kay Smith Hayden. How can we as teachers get parents to test for or admit their child has autistic tendencies, autism, so we know how to go about teaching, working with the child in the appropriate manner for their best education?
Yeah, I think around this is, I think the best label you can give a person is their name, and first of all, and I think sometimes we get caught up in that the individual has to have a particular label. Now, my belief is, first of all, if the individual needs some further supports, is that when we're considering the proposition of autism, there is such a spectrum of, we would say, individuality or ability within the whole idea of having autism as an attribute. And what I would do in such a situation is I would try to do some problem solving. Putting things on the table so we can chat about them is where are some of the areas that are difficult or that are struggles for that particular learner, and how can we support that individual in terms of services, in terms of strategies. Now, my belief is that we should be differentiating all our classrooms in the first place. What that would mean is we're looking at supports to make learning work for everybody. And that's very important. But I think some individuals need some further support beyond that. And that's where we would bring in some special education services and related services that would meet those individual needs. So I would actually take a team process with that and put some things on the table and look at how can we give the individual the best education they can get to make learning happen so that they can advance and become an educated adult.
It's really interesting, the whole idea of behaviors, because obviously there are some behaviors that really need to be looked at and stopped because they're a danger to others or to themselves.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it's really takes a special kind of teacher to look at behaviors and think about them in what trying to interpret, because all behavior is a form of communication. And
an
example that I have of that is that my son has some language but very little, and he was basically didn't have a very good communication system. He had a little bit of everything that we had tried over the years, and he had this new high school teacher when he was a sophomore, and he new to the school, but this was a very good teacher from another transition program or another high school, and I didn't realize what was going on until at the IEP, but I was very pleasantly surprised because I had had contact with the teacher, but his report at the IEP was that my son was showing behaviors of, like, pushing the papers away and refusing to do any work. And
mm-hmm.
what his way of dealing with that was to find out what I was doing with him at home, because he knew that I was doing teaching him at home using another method and trying to teach my son to type. And so when he heard that I was teaching math at a different level and he was still trying to teach my son 1 plus 1 equals 2, he thought, well, maybe he's bored. So he started using the kinds of things I was doing at home, but without telling me, like he just started doing it. And in this report, he said that my son's behavior has dramatically changed. And in the past, beforehand, all the teachers, if they saw negative behaviors like that, they would think that he's been uncooperative, you know, he doesn't understand the one plus the one. He's got to learn to sit better, but not thinking, well, maybe they're bored. And maybe we need to raise our expectations. And
right.
So it really takes a special kind of teacher. You would hope that more teachers would be that way.
I think that's really very important, too. And I think making education engaging and of interest to the learner. So, for example, Pedro, who I talked about before, who really liked his whales a lot when he was a little bit younger, one of the things that he had repeating over and over on his IEP will initiate and engage in communication with other people. And so that was problematic simply because I think what they were doing is having him communicate about things that weren't of interest to him. So all of a sudden, what they did is they had him talk about whales. And Pedro is initiating and engaging in communication. And what they wanted to do after that is get him to branch out with that. So they said, Pedro, how do you use whales in math? So he could talk about the whales being on the blocks. Pedro, how do you use whales to finish your work? He could talk about getting the whale stamp on the paper. And what are some other types of work that you do where you get the whale stamp? And what they were gradually doing is getting him to branch out in his communication as a strategy. So it really is looking at putting the learner first and foremost in the center of everything we do and taking steps. And it is a process. It is a journey. It's a one day at a time type of proposition. We also, Chantel, had a student named Matt who threw a desk at a teacher. And what had happened is right away there were a lot of really huge concerns, and justifiably safety should always be a very big concern in any school. And so the team was talking about a therapeutic support model for Matt and things like that. And I went back and I said, what is Matt communicating with his behavior? And when they really investigated this, they found some pretty, I would say, hard things. It was a hard situation for Matt. So they found out that his father had left his mother, and Matt and his dad had been fairly close. And his mom had had a difficult time finding work in the local community. So Matt had been living with grandma and grandpa. And grandpa and Matt didn't really get along that well. And so here Matt had lost his father, his mother had moved away, and he was living with somebody who didn't get along with. And that was a really tough situation. So what I did is I asked the team, I said, I'm not disagreeing that I think Matt needs some therapeutic supports, but I asked them, what is your reintegration plan for Matt? And because I believe that students shouldn't have to earn their way into a general education classroom, I believe that they could do something to possibly earn their way out. But when that takes place, is there should be a reintegration plan. And that was a hard question to ask at the time, because I think it was still fairly new that Matt had thrown a desk at a teacher. But here's what they said. They felt that Matt should have at least one quarter in a therapeutic type of environment. And they also wanted him, if he was to come back, to be getting outside therapeutic support. And the second thing is to show an acceptance of his current situation, which was kind of an interesting one. But it took Matt not a quarter. It took him a semester, but he did get back. And that's my belief, is that's the way the system should work when you're looking at the concept of least restrictive environment. Is the magnetic field, when you're looking at least restrictive environment, should always be headed towards the general education classroom, which to me, that's the least restrictive environment. And if a person is in any other situation other than that, is what is our integration plan if they've never had that opportunity, or their reintegration plan? And I think behavior is sometimes the toughest one, because that's the one, you know, where people will say behind the scenes, you know what, he threw a desk at a teacher. and they kind of throw away the key. And go ahead.
And I'm not saying it's the right thing to do, but you can understand why that's scary. It's different when you have a student who, like, might just stem constantly or get up and leave the classroom, because that can be distracting, but it's not dangerous, at least not to other people. Whereas if someone's throwing a desk, you can understand why they're hesitant or why they're nervous. But you're absolutely right. You have to have a plan for how do you get him back in a great supportive situation, because otherwise you're just asking for another possible situation to occur.
There was another question, I think, that kind of had to do with those behaviors that are maybe not safety types of issues. So a person who maybe is making some noise or is doing some types of stimming behavior things such as that, or maybe prefers to work in a quieter type of setting. And I saw a general education teacher do something fantastic that has really stuck with me. She said after she had done a particular lesson, she said, students, right now we're going to do our assignments, and you have some choice of how you do your assignment. The first way you can do it is you can work alone at your desk in the room. You could work with another person at your desk in the room, but remember our rule is that you talk just above a whisper. You could work alone on the floor in the room. You can work with somebody else on the floor in the room if you talk just above a whisper. And she said, Mrs. C is going to go down to the library, and if you would like to work there, let me know, and you could choose to work in the library. What she just did is she made it okay for people to learn in multiple ways and have some choice in terms of that. So rather than having to pull out one individual all the time, students all had the choice of the way they did that. When I went to college, there was some choices of where you did your work. So there was this really quiet library called Memorial Library where you could hear a pin drop. There was another library called Helen C. White where you could get some help with people proofreading your papers and things such as that. But where I chose to do my work, it was in the Memorial Union. It was a student union. On the second floor, they had this big classical music room that overlooked the lake. And I'm one of those people who likes music going. And so I, as an adult, had all these choices. Why can't we start giving more of that type of thing for students, for all learners, rather than making somebody stand out and making a door of a classroom kind of a revolving door for that individual? And that's a really good differentiated strategy, because there were other people who would also prefer to work in a quieter place, or other individuals that wanted to work with someone, maybe a favorite person.
No, that's really good point. It's funny because I just went on a college tour with my daughter to look at possibly colleges next year. And every time we toured the libraries, they always went into which floor was for what kind of learner. Like if you like quiet, you go to the first floor. And if you like noise, you go up to this floor. So it's very obvious that they do have all those, when they have choices, people have specific environments they like to learn in. So you're right. You know, if it's possible, why not try and do that from early on?
Right. I think that's great. And that, to me, would be a sign of a good university who gives their learners choices and options, because I think that our general society is very diverse. And the more that we provide supports and options for all, I think the less we have to individually adapt for learners who may need a definite, we might say, higher dose of some of those options sometimes. And the more we think in this way and we support people in this way, I think it makes our job a lot easier.
Right. Here's a good question from Pamela in Somerville.
Okay.
Can you please comment on the transition of a child from a self-contained learning environment one-on-one into a preschool classroom? I'm specifically interested in whether programs, i.e. social programs, can actually be carried out in that environment, i.e. teaching a child to have a conversation with a peer. Is it appropriate to attempt such a program with a typical peer? And if so, what is the appropriate way to do it?
That's a great question, because I have visited classrooms that were for learners who were identified only as having autism. And so, for example, I saw a classroom that I was doing on an observation. There was one such type of classroom even at the time I was teaching. And every single student had these significant communication goals. But if I really looked at that particular classroom, there were no real communication models. And so your best communication models are going to be your good communicators. And so you want to surround learners with those good communicators, first of all. My second indicator is, what are those passions and those interests of the individual, and can we use those as a springboard for communication and actually get them to talk to somebody else about those particular types of things? I'm also a big believer in having a definite transition plan. I think that the individual's teacher should be able to get to know things about the individual. So what are their favorite things? What are their interests? All of those things that will help support them when they go into that new situation. And if we look at some of those things, I think we start out trying to pave the way for success. Alfie Cohen said, the most important thing that a teacher does with a student is build a relationship with them. And I think that you've got to know those things about that learner to be able to teach them. And I think going into it with that kind of mindset, and that we're also working together as a team, is I might not know everything, but we've got a team process here, and we've got some individuals with expertise on the team, and we'll problem solve this, and we'll take it one step at a time and support the learner. So I'm a firm believer is surround people with those good communication models. It's never too early to start, because think about where they're going to end up. They're going to end up in the community with all sorts of types of people communicating in different ways. And the more we can teach those experiences when somebody is young, but also remembering it's never too late, is I think we're going to have better communication skills as an outcome of that.
You're absolutely right. And better behaviors as well.
Absolutely.
Here's a great question from Diane Walker in Temperance. Can inclusion work with just the general education teacher and a parapro in the classroom? My son is in the sixth grade, but at a 4.5 grade level. How can inclusion work for him?
Now, first of all, my belief is, if you're looking at a general educator, is I do believe when they're planning for their lessons is they need to think about everybody in their classroom. And to me these days, every classroom is a diverse classroom. Every classroom that I see, because every teacher that I'm encountering these days will say there are students without a special education identification that are 1 to 2 grade levels behind in certain subjects or areas, things such as that. That is not a unique thing. And then there are also learners who we would say are gifted in the same classroom. And so you've got a really wide range of learning. And when you think about it, is it's really important for the initial planning is for that person to really think about everybody in the classroom. I believe there should also be a person who is a special educator if that individual qualifies for those types of services. A special educator should be helping with the paraeducator or the teaching assistant in terms of carrying out some of their we would say responsibilities. So paraeducators carry out the teacher-designed responsibilities. So if that person qualifies for special education services, I think they should get them. But I've seen some really interesting configurations with teams because I've met learners with autism or Asperger syndrome who actually have gifts. And sometimes their gifts are specialized. So, for example, Trevor, who's a student in elementary school that I've met in recent times, he is doing college-age mathematics, but I wouldn't trust Trevor to cross the street on his own. And so we have very interesting learning configurations. My big thing is I want to make sure students are getting supports in the areas that they need them. And sometimes if that individual is qualifying, is an individual with autism or Asperger syndrome within the spectrum of abilities and they qualify for those services, I want to make sure that a specialist is overseen and looking at that. Do I feel that individual could potentially fade services as the individual is getting more independent? Absolutely.
You bring up some really good points there. But you keep going back to, and it totally makes sense about the fact that you need to have people involved who are helping with setting the supports in place.
Right.
And not just a matter of placing people. And often that happens with kids with Asperger's. They're thrown in situations, and everyone just thinks, well, they're failing in certain areas. But because they're so neurotypical in other ways, then obviously they don't need our help. And it's such a tragedy for these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's another good question. We have so many of them here. This is from Ann Pisteni in Lincoln, California.
Okay.
My son had psychological testing by my request, which showed that he was mentally retarded. He has a severe language delay. We refused special education class because he was mimicking behaviors of the other children. However, he seems to be getting everything in the regular classroom but has issues with paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
He does have any autistic symptoms. However, when tested, they said he does not have it. What do I do from here?
First of all, I'm glad to hear the statement in that he seems to be getting what he needs in the general education environment. I'm probably first and foremost concerned about that rather than particular labels and things such as that. My big belief is how can we get the learner the best education services that they're entitled to? And that's it seems to be that's happening. The second thing I heard from that is that he's not paying attention sometimes. And first of all, where I begin with the not paying attention is I go back to our general education counterparts, and I think everybody that's on the call, go back to when you were in school, in elementary, middle, or high school. Were you always paying attention? Did you ever daydream? Did you ever do some behaviors yourself that signaled you weren't entirely with a particular lesson or lecture or something like that? And I think everybody, one of us, we'd have to confess that, yes, we did that. Now, we may see certain things to a more extreme degree with a particular individual, but that's, I think, for what I actually do when I'm looking at a learner, that's where I start assessing what are their interests, passions, and fascinations, and how could I perhaps combine some of those things or weave them into their day to make learning more interesting or dynamic or less boring for that individual so we up the ante with attention. I cannot begin to tell you how many situations I go into where people are not really thinking of the student's interests or passions or fascinations and actually doing the opposite of my belief, taking them away, rather than looking at ways they can support the learner. So could that be a strategy to help the learner with attention? And actually, we do cover that in Just Give Him the Whale, because we looked at 20 different reasons why you would support someone with that, and one of them is to help the individual pay attention.
Right. Good. So much good information here. Okay. Here's a question from Christina Ware from Glenridge. What are some signs, behaviors that a child is struggling in a mainstream classroom setting, even though academic performance is average and not worsening?
Can you repeat the first part of that, Chantel?
Yes. What are some signs or behaviors that a child struggling in a mainstream classroom setting, even though academic performance is average and not worsening?
In terms of struggling, I think where I would start is I'd ask the individual how things are going. I'd find the best way that they could communicate that to you. I would observe that particular individual. I would also look at are they enjoying school? Are there parts of school that they're enjoying? Are they dreading school? Are there behaviors that they don't want to go? If those types of things are taking place, I would look into or investigate some of the reasons behind that. And so it sounds like things aren't so bad if the individual seems to be doing well. But in terms of, I think, a bottom line question, I would ask, do they like school?
Right. Okay. Now here's a question from Lisa Wolf of Walla Walla.
Okay.
My 18-year-old son has some receptive language as well as a ton of vocabulary in his head, but his spontaneous language and conversation skills are still so very, very lacking. What drills or programming can we do to improve this? I'd love to be able to have the school work on these suggested programming too. Help. He's currently in an autism classroom in the public education high school. He had home programming ABA style from age 2 to 13. We apparently didn't build the right building blocks at the time. Sigh.
Okay. So what I would look at for an individual, so it sounds like there's a lot of things going on in terms of what the person is thinking about and concepts and things such as that, and it's a matter of getting them out. One of the things that we did for a particular individual is we encouraged her first and foremost to communicate using words and using her voice, and what we also had was some backup communication approaches. So she had an augmentative communication system that was a hip talker. So when it was hard for her to get out everything that she was thinking, she could program in some of the statements that she wanted to make. And she actually got pretty good at using it, but we still encourage her first and foremost to be able to use her words. Now, there would be some different types of software programs. We looking at like PicWriter types of programs that would give a voice output and things such as that in terms of the individual, depending on their grade and their understanding of things, is to be able to actually have something that would give audio playback or feedback with something perhaps that they were writing, and then maybe having them afterwards read something such as that, so that we were working on having them increase those responses, increase what they're bringing forward. And I think there's lots of different types of technology, I think, that can bring that out. I'd be a fool to say that there's one program or one way of making that work. Work with a lot of assistive technology people these days, and absolutely love many of the things that I'm seeing out there. There are a lot of school districts that I'm working with these days, too, that are working with services that have like lending libraries for assistive technology and software where they can have like maybe a trial period with it to see if it's the right thing to support that individual. Now, my belief with any assistive technology, whether it's a device or it's software, is really our goal should be to fade it out as much as possible. Some people will need certain lifelong supports, but others, maybe it's a stepping stone for them at that given time in terms of what they need for supports and their abilities.
But also, it seems that this person is in an autism classroom, and even if he has the assistive technology, it sounds to me like maybe he's not getting enough opportunity to practice with people because
right.
if he's in, you know, if he's in a autism classroom, is he getting out enough? Does he have any inclusion at all, any mainstreaming at all, any opportunities to practice?
Right. What are the social models? Where are the communication
right.
models? And my fear is if we keep somebody away from that for too long, is I think we're losing such important opportunities. Is when you think about it, is probably most of us on this call went through an education where you moved on with a particular group of people from grade to grade, maybe in an elementary school, maybe you moved on with them middle school and high school in some cases. You will never have that opportunity again. And what happens with a lot of students who do not get included is they get sometimes transported to where the program is. And sometimes from year to year, that's in different schools, different places. And so you kind of disconnect all those opportunities for your social models and people that you move on with from grade to grade. Now, I realize that some families kind of move around and travel and things such as that, but I still think the inclusive endeavor is just as important when that takes place.
Okay. I don't know if you'd like to answer this question or not. Jason McIntyre,
okay.
Cato, New York. How do we curb his energy to make it more useful instead of destructive? Also, his attention span to last longer than just a few minutes.
Yeah. First of all, with the energy is I think what we should do is put that on the table because if I look at Jason, who we talked about in the beginning, he had a lot of energy kind of running around the school, things such as that. A couple of things I think were very supportive to him. First of all, one was sensory integration, and there were some different sensory experiences that he was given. One of them is when he was in the self-contained classroom, they had a net swing in the middle of the room. Now, I had not seen a general education first grade classroom that had a net swing in it before, and it wasn't that people were opposed to it necessarily, but would there be some alternative ways? And one of the ways that we found out right away was a kid's rocking chair. And so when I got the rocking chair for Jason, I didn't buy just one, I bought two, so that everybody in the classroom could use them. And they were in the reading corner, and kids loved them. You know, they'd be sitting in them. And even for a while, Jason's desk chair became a rocking chair. And then the second thing that when he was passing by the gymnasium, he'd like to go between the tumbling mats and have somebody put pressure, kind of like Temple Grandin's squeeze box. And the kids in the school saw that, and they said, well, we realize he runs around and makes noise, but do they have to crush him in those mats? And so we needed to also educate the school about student supports. And we did it in a way where we didn't do a token autism type of thing. We did something where we said that what do you do well for all – we do this in classrooms for all the students. And then we said what do you also have challenges with? And so we had every student talk about that, and then we had Jason at that time talk a little bit about autism. And we created kind of that sensitivity because everybody was talking about where they had strengths and where they had challenges. Jason talked about his strengths as well. He used some supported communication with that, but I think that was really a good step. Also, I would find a way for the individual who has a lot of energy to look at what are some classroom jobs that take place during the, we would say, a typical class. So are there any things that need to be passed out? Are there things that need to be delivered? Are there some active learning opportunities for the assignment? Things such as that to make the classroom more of an active learning type of proposition. And I feel that's an important thing for all students, is that it's an important tool and an educational bag of tricks for all learners.
You know, this brings up a question that I've been wanting to ask you, and that is your philosophy or your attitude about how do you include someone in a classroom in the sense of, does the teacher know? Is something said to the peers ahead of time? And does that, is that different depending on how old the child is and how intrusive the situation is?
In terms of what we've typically done is we have included an individual and had them start and look at maybe where are some of the things that maybe students are asking questions about. And what I try to do rather than making it a token thing is I create some kind of sensitivity experience where we're all learners are doing that. And I think that one lesson where you're looking at where people have strengths and where people have challenges is a great thing to do with everybody pretty much up front. And I think letting them get to know the individual a little bit first, and they may see where some differences exist, and but educating them pretty quick. And I think it's very important to create the right sensitivity in the situation. And I found out very quickly is that once you educate the kids, is kids just are really outstanding. Is I think, first of all, prejudice is a learned behavior, and the way to get out of it is through education and experience. And I think the biggest thing that's the most important thing is how the teacher is a model for the learners with the particular student or individual. And I think that if we educate in a very sensitive way and that we focus on similarities and talk about where we can as a classroom community support differences, and that goes for everybody, I think we have a greater chance of being successful. And that's another Alfie Cohen type of concept, is how do we build a classroom community? And I think that's something that's important for all learners.
Mm-hmm. And how do you handle, I know that you talked before about how the teachers are part of the team, but what about in a high school situation or a junior high situation where, you know, a child can be, you know, you might have 2,000-3,000 students and they can be in a variety of classes?
Right.
Do you tell the teacher ahead of time, or what are your thoughts on that? Because I've seen it happen different ways.
Yeah, I would definitely always tell teachers ahead of time. I think that it's important if you have a student who's coming in any educational situation with an IEP, is any teacher who's working with them is part of the IEP team. And I saw some not such great situations in like Chicago public schools where individuals didn't get their IEPs who were general education teachers. And I think that's not a good thing. And so I think the teachers up front should know some things. And I think we should definitely be doing transitional types of things the year before. So anybody that we know who's going to be a teacher that following year, we should bring in to observe. We should talk about what are successful strategies. We should do processes where we focus and we have in the student's file what are their interests, what are success strategies, things such as that, I think that a communication process definitely needs to happen. Now, with the students, I think we have to really create that sensitivity in the classroom to be able to, I would say, introduce that particular learner and focus on similarities rather than differences, as I mentioned before.
Well, it's really interesting because I understand what you're saying, but I know, for example, in the high schools in our area or any Southern California, well, I should say San Diego area, from the spring to the fall, they don't know who the teachers are going to be or what classes they're going to have in the high schools or the junior highs. Often it's not even until August that we know what the schedule is going to be. And I don't know if it's because of, money situations with the budget, and so they're not quite sure who's going to be around teaching what, but it's quiet. You can try and be as much of a planner as you can, but a lot of times it's always a mad rush in September.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I'm working with Big City, too, with Chicago. And my belief is this, I think most effective leaders, I'm going to go do a thing for leaders this next week in Michigan. And I think effective leaders know that it's very important, if you could at all possibly do this, is when you're scheduling, is to think of learner diversity first and foremost, and look at matches,
right.
Look at communication as early as possible, because I really think there should be a transition process. And if anybody is able to do something about that, I think that is very, very important, and it's very helpful.
You're absolutely right. So now here's a question from Lisa Kirk from Caseyville.
Okay.
My son is 14 years old in the eighth grade. He has been in a contained room since third grade. I would like to mainstream him and try a parochial high school. Any ideas on what would be the best approach for this? Thank you so much.
I think, first of all, is there are probably some reasons why the individual doesn't want to continue with the public school. And I think if you're looking at maybe changing schools, there are certain reasons that people want to do that. And I would start out with maybe some information and providing some information in terms of like the kinds of things that we would do with the MAPS process, for example, is who is the individual, what are their interests and strengths, what are their challenges, what are dreams, what are nightmares, and what are the person's greatest needs, and talk about, visiting the school, finding out kind of what are the services. I think it's important to find out if there is a good match, if you're thinking of a private school for an individual. And I think most private schools I know, when somebody's coming in, is do the typical things you would do for any learner, is really focus on services. So, for example, there is a learner that I've been supporting for a number of years as a consultant, and he went to college this year. And we very much looked at the student services office. We really focused on a lot of those types of things and started kind of talking from that aspect. So I think anything you would typically do to learn about that school and learn about that situation. Also, I think if somebody is looking at a school, perhaps they may know other families and students who go there, and it might be good to talk to them in terms of some things that they are feeling are good and people that can be honest in terms of what's taking place in that particular environment.
That's a really great point. Other parents are a very good resource.
Oh, it's fantastic. you know, all the great changes in the field, all the landmarks in special education, we wouldn't have inclusion if it wasn't for families.
Well, it takes a group of people. And
absolutely.
And there's nothing that can stop a group of people.
That's right. The Margaret Mead quote, when you have a small group of committed people, you can change the world.
Exactly. So here's Maria in Ann Arbor.
Okay.
What is the best way to help a child who has some aggressive behavior stay in the mix and yet keep the other children safe?
Okay. First of all, I'm really a big believer. There's actually this one workshop that I do. It's called Addressing Adventuresome Behavior While Keeping the Dignity of Everyone Intact. And I believe is a lot of people look at behavior as something is going on inside the individual. When I found out in pretty much every case is that there are external factors that have to do with the behavior. And what I do is I do an analysis and look at these particular areas. I look, first of all, are there any environmental factors that we need to look at? And I've got a series of questions around that. The second one is I look at, are there any communication factors? The third one is, are there any choice and control factors? Are there any teaching and implementation factors? Are there any physiological types of factors? And you can get into a lot of different areas. I've actually got a functional analysis and problem-solving process that I feel deals with a lot of these factors that I find impact on learners the most, and that's in the You're Welcome books. There are three booklets, and one is on positive behavior supports. And again, all of these things that I've been talking about as well is looking at, are we making sure that the day is engaging for the person? Are they getting some choice and control with things that are meaningful and important to them? I think that's all part of this mix in terms of supporting the learner. But I think if we can do something about some of the external factors which may be impacting on the individual, I think we're probably taking steps. And it sounds like in this situation, maybe that they're moving towards some positive change. So I hope it continues to go that way.
That's great. It's always nice to hear about positive change.
Absolutely.
You've talked a bit about, or quite a bit about inclusion and what the criteria is, but someone asks a specific question. Maybe there's parts that you may want to bring up here that you haven't mentioned yet. I don't know who this is from, but the question is, criteria for the kid to fit in inclusion, what are the staff requirements, ratio, and other facilities or environmental needs?
Okay. First of all, in terms of ratios and things such as that, I think there are some in terms of that they talk about special education ratios in terms of caseloads for special educators and numbers of, for example, paraeducators that they could used to support situations. I think those are typically under the auspices of particular states. So you'd be looking at state boards of education or departments of public instruction, things such as that. What was the rest of that question?
Okay, the rest of the question was in terms of the facilities or environment. I guess anything about the classroom or anything about the school?
There are also typically state regulations with numbers of students in a classroom, and I think that is also state-controlled, if I'm not mistaken. So I know I've worked pretty closely in Wisconsin and Illinois, And with Wisconsin, it's the Department of Public Instruction. With Illinois, it's the Board of Education. With a lot of states, it's called the Department of Education. And I think there is criteria set by the state with numbers of students in classrooms.
Right. And how do you feel about classrooms that are, you know, more crowded than others? For example, some class in some areas, they only have 20 students to a classroom in the, you know, 1 to 3 or kindergarten to 3. Other school districts may have 30 in a classroom. How do you feel that that impacts the inclusion, especially with kids who have sensory issues?
Yeah, I think it definitely does affect students. And here's kind of a phenomena that I see quite a bit, is what happens is that certain general education teachers become known as the ones that will do the inclusive education. And what happens is sometimes those classrooms have a higher percentage of individuals with IEPs, just because we do something that we call in the field clustering of those students. So if it's like a fourth grade classroom, all the learners who have IEPs or autism go to a particular general education teacher. And the way that I was taught with Ann Donnellan and Lou Brown is what they said, they talked about the concept of natural proportion. And so what we should try to do is get our classrooms to reflect what the community is all about. So say, for example, anybody who's on the phone call in your community, let's say we just dropped 100 people at random in a room. So what would happen is we would say anywhere from 10 to 12% would be individuals that we'd say would have high incidence types of challenges. So that would be things such as learning disabilities, ADD, things such as that. Anywhere from 1 to 3% would have a more significant disability. We'd say learners with more significant cognitive challenges, cerebral palsy, things such as that. Autism is an interesting one because we're seeing kind of some of the configuration in terms of our population changing. So the one in every 91 births, you know, we'd say maybe one or two people potentially drop down. And I think sometimes classroom numbers can be affected by this phenomena that we do call clustering. So I think we should try to make it balanced as possible. I think we should try to stay within the state criteria and legal limits for those types of things. And I think most states have some oversight in some way, shape, or form with that, whether it's just schools reporting numbers in classrooms, things such as that, audits, et cetera. But I think it's really important when you're looking at individuals with autism that you think about is what's the optimum learning environment. So I think we should stay within those particular limits. Now, I'm not saying that individuals need to be in this small, self-contained setting. I think people have said, oh, they can't be with anybody else. They need to be with people like their own. They need a quiet environment. They can only communicate with people like themselves. I just think we need to look at quality general environments, and I think that's really an important concept.
That's an important point that you make there. Here's another question from Diane Walker in Temperance.
Okay.
She had talked about her son who was in a sixth grade but had a 4.5 grade level of comprehension. But she has a more specific question now. She asked, what can teachers do to make inclusion work for a child that is not at grade level? Teachers can be sometimes resistive to the idea of making modifications to the curriculum when the child is not at grade level. Can you, for example, give examples for social studies and science?
To me, this is actually a larger type of question. So I would like them first and foremost to look at the way that they plan for learners. So I actually have a process for that, and these are kind of some of my questions for differentiation. So if people are planning, for example, for a unit, I would say, and you can use different number configurations for this, but I think you'll understand the concept. So if we're looking at, first of all, a unit, let's say, what are the 1 to 3 particular, we would say, goals or learning targets that all students need to know? So that's the first question. Then we would say next, what are the 4 to 6 goals or learning targets that most students need to know? And the third thing would be, what are the 7 to 10 types of goals or learning targets that some students would need to know? And that way, if we think of breaking down, if we're looking at a learning spectrum for anything, we don't have to get hung up in as much as who's what grade level behind or who is this going to be difficult for. Rather, let's look at what the individual is able to learn. And let's look at kind of their learning capacity. And let's start out for everybody, what are the 1 to 3 things that all students need to know? And if we can keep going further with that individual, that's fantastic. But I think we have to think in a way where we're breaking things down and differentiating them for the classroom. And it's fascinating is that, you know, we would think sometimes for learners who have autism or Asperger's syndrome that, you know, we'd be looking at more the 1 to 3. And I don't find that to be the case at all. I think individuals have specialty areas. They have interests. But I think it's important to look at that concept so you're not excluding somebody just because they're a grade level behind or that you feel that they shouldn't be in the same classroom just because they might not learn all the same things that another learner might.
Very good. Here's a question from Suzanne Litchford in Channelview. The school district my grandson is in is going to try and pull all the autistic children they have out of the private school. He has been in the school for 4 years and has learned so much. What is the best way to convince them to keep him there? That's the first part of a question. Then there's another question that has to do with the dog. But we'll start with that one.
The first question, I actually like that question a lot because why would we change something that's already working well? Here is where we create a double standard sometimes for people who have a disability is we say, oh, when you get to this age, you go into this particular program. Well, to me, that's kind of, we would say, defying the whole concept of individual education program, which is really part of Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, is we create an IEP. And I think first and foremost, if it's going well, which that was communicated, is that we want it to keep going well. So why would we change that particular model? Now, somebody could use the same type of thing. They say, well, you know, he's in a self-contained learning environment and it's going well. Why would we include? And I think with that particular question is we need to look in the future for that individual. What are going to be all the requirements of the real world for that individual? If you want the individual to live, work, play, and become educated in the community, I think we all need to learn together to be able to make that happen successfully. And again, I'll go back to that original thing that I said, successful school inclusion leads to successful adult inclusion.
Right. I agree with you. Now I'm trying to find that question again because there it is.
There's a lot of them.
I know, but here's the second part to the same question from Suzanne, from the same person. I have also purchased a Labradoodle puppy to train as a service dog.
Okay.
He will let the puppy, so the boy will let the puppy sit by him, but does not allow the puppy to get into his lap. Any suggestions on how to get him to bond with the puppy?
Okay. That's one I almost feel that I have to see the interaction with the particular individual and the puppy to be able to look at that. I do know a particular student who did have a service dog, and I think one of the things that I would do is think about what are some of the most fun things for the individual. What are some things that they like to do the most, and include the puppy in those things. And so making that puppy a member of things that are positive for the individual, and associating the puppy with those positive experiences. But I kind of like to see a little bit more about the way they interact. That's one I'd almost want to see, but making it as positive as of an experience as possible.
I'd like to offer another perspective on this as well, only because my son, who's 20, does have a service dog,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted a dog for a few years. He would wake up with a smile, and he'd spell out, "I dreamed I had a dog," and he used his wanting the dog to help him work on his, he had like a self-employment business at school, and he was
okay.
motivated, he was putting aside the money to help pay for the dog, because it was a service dog and there were fees involved. So I said I would match whatever he saved. Boy, that was such a motivator. Talk about
excellent. Using money.
But you know, he's a teenager. I don't have money growing on trees in my house. So the thing is that if you are looking at my son and the dog and you are thinking through your neurotypical eyes of what bonding with a dog looks like, you're going to say my dog or that my son has not at all any kind of bond with his service dog, Handsome, because you'll be looking through the typical eyes of what a neurotypical person would do. But actually, my son has a very good bond with the dog. He just shows it differently, and I think I only can know from what the person is saying here that he will let the puppy sit by him but does not allow the puppy to get in his lap. Well, my son loves to have the dog sitting next to him but also does not like the dog all over him, which is kind of funny because I thought he would like the deep pressure part of the dog on top of him.
Okay.
And he likes it, say, if he's lying down in bed and the dog's just on his legs or feet. But he doesn't like all the commotion of the dog in his lap because, again, my son has a lot of sensory issues, and so the dog moves his head or he's licking. It's not something he can prepare himself for. But yet, if you see them riding in the car together and my son is sitting in his seat, the dog is on the floor between my son's legs looking straight up at my son, and my son is looking at him straight in the eyes and playing with his ears and giggling away.
Mm-hmm.
They go to the park. He throws his way of throwing the ball. It's to throw it like he's playing catch with somebody. So the dog actually jumps up and catches it, and my son will ask for a play date. He says, "I want a play date with Handsome," and that's going to the park.
Okay.
But a lot of people, when they come to the house, they say, "Wow, your son doesn't like the dog, does he?" Because they don't realize what my son is like normally and how he reacts or relates differently to the dog. But he does. He does have a bond with a dog. It just doesn't look the way it does to neurotypical people.
Right, and it may be specific to certain activities. It may be specific to certain ways of playing with that particular dog, as you definitely depicted. And how do we make that positive? And I think it's a matter of trying different things out. It sounds like, you know, you tried lots of different experiences and discovered what was effective and what you might steer away from a little bit more. And I think people are so quick to make judgments, you know, and that's human nature. Sometimes is that, you know, we kind of, you know, sum someone up in just a short period of time without really knowing the big picture, and there's definitely a big picture in what you just described.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's a couple of questions from Remo Molino from Frederick.
Okay.
Here in the state of Maryland, there is a new law that children must pass their middle and or high school standardized test to be diploma bound. If mm-hmm. not, the child will have to go the non-diploma bound route and be placed in a self-contained learning for life classroom. It appears Maryland is going in reverse and not forward. What are your thoughts on this?
I guess states make, you know, particular rules and regulations with these types of testing experiences. Now, my belief with standards is how do we make them work for us rather than fight them? So I would like to, first of all, when you're considering a particular test and that's going to be one of the criteria for a particular individual is, first of all, that we have the best access in terms of the individual taking the test. So first of all, are there any adaptations or can we provide certain things that match the needs of that particular learner? So for example, this was Brian, who's a learner in the state of Illinois, and he uses what is like a Dynavox to help him with communication. So the State Board of Education said it was okay that Brian had things programmed into the Dynavox and that he could answer with the Dynavox, and also that he would have an assistant helping him with the Dynavox, and it also took more time for him to use that, so he was able to have that additional time to respond just by mere use of the technology. It took more time. And so those were some things where we made standardized tests work. However, I don't feel people are standardized. So if placement is being determined by a test for a person who has special education types of needs, is I think that's more like a one-size-fits-all type of mentality. And I am more of a believer of supporting the individual where they're at. I think sometimes that particular type of test can take away the individualized out of the IEP. Now, for Brian, who I was just talking about how he took that test, I think we individualized the way he was taking the test. But if that was an excuse, if he didn't meet the criteria of that test not to include him, I think we're not offering the least restrictive environment for that particular individual. So I have a problem with kind of that one size fits all. So I want people to have access, but I don't want a test to determine whether you could be included or not.
Right. You're absolutely right. Okay, here's one from Eric Pelletier in Marathon. I'm not sure of the beginning of this statement, so I'm just going to read what it said, and then we'll try and figure out what it means. How can do homework so he understands and doesn't get discouraged? Oh, how to get him maybe to do his homework so he understands and doesn't get discouraged. When he gets discouraged, he usually turns on me or on something that I want him to learn. So how do you get a child to focus on his homework and not get discouraged, I guess, if he's not getting it right away?
Yeah, first of all, I just want to go to the roots of homework. And the purpose of homework, and this is what pretty much resoundingly all general educators have told me, is that the purpose is for practice and reinforcement. And first of all, we had sometimes what was taking place with individuals who were included, all of a sudden they're getting like 3 hours of homework a night. And the family is struggling and helping their son. It's frustrating. and it becomes punishment rather than practice and reinforcement. So my belief with homework is that, first of all, it may need to be adapted for an individual who has an IEP based on how long it takes them to do typical, we would say, like problems, like math problems, things such as that, which would be homework. So, for example, Sarah was a student who, during a particular classroom period, was only able to do about half of the problems that her peers were doing, and they were focusing on the 1 to 3 most important things that everybody needed to know with lessons. And so what they did is they said for Sarah is she would have half the amount of homework based on what she was showing her performance to be in the classroom. And there's not a single teacher that I talk to in the entire world, because I've asked many, many this question, who feels that a student should have 3 hours of homework a night. One of the formulas that I heard from teachers is they said 10 minutes per grade level. And looking at that, it still doesn't add up anywhere to 3 hours a night. So I think we have to look at the roots. It's for practice and reinforcement. It may need to be adapted, and it shouldn't be to the point where it's a punishment for someone.
Right. Or for the parents.
Absolutely, because you know what we're doing is, here's kind of the dynamic that happens, is you say a student is having difficulties with literacy. We give them all this literacy homework, and it just takes hours and hours, and it's the thing the student struggles the most with, and the student doesn't want to go to school anymore. And
right.
What you're doing is you're creating the profile for a dropout.
Exactly. Okay, so here's a question from Ashley D. Isles, Jr. from Philadelphia.
Okay.
I would like to know how I am able to advocate for my son and have people understand, accept my son and his needs. What is a good way for a parent to advocate for inclusion for their son?
I think, first of all, get excited about your son. I think also taking a big part in the IEP meeting. So I have seen families just do some amazing things with that particular process, is that they've done, you know, a part about educational history, and they brought in photos, looked at kind of like over the years what had happened. They focused on things where their son was making progress, looking at where we still have to work on particular things, celebrating accomplishments. There was a family that I worked with that did a celebration picnic at the end of the year for what their son accomplished. And I think those are some great things. And in terms of the inclusive process, I think that first of all, looking at, are there any local examples, first of all, of individuals being included, and really focusing on how can we successfully do this. So I think when I look at a family, is the family is the expert on their son or daughter. They know what works. They know what doesn't work. They have their son or daughter for the other 18 hours of the day. They were their son or daughter's first teacher. And so I think we need to bring that expertise to the table in terms of a proposition like this. I think the more I see people creating collaborative, positive experiences around it, I think it becomes infectious in a positive way with the team, and that it's a very good thing in terms of taking steps. And I think that's a great way to start. I know that I'm not Pollyanna, and I know it doesn't always turn out that way, but you can't fault yourself if you didn't start out that way.
Very good. Here's a question from Carrie in Saginaw. My son is 9 years old and has Asperger's. He's in a regular education classroom, third grade, with supports in writing, and also sees a social worker and speech therapist. Normally, he does very well in this setting. However, this year, he has started running out of the classroom and out of the school whenever he gets into overload. How can we get this behavior to stop? When I ask him why, he says the teacher's voice is too loud and that she is bossy. Now he interprets things very different from what may be occurring, so I am really lost on this.
Wow. I mean, I'm first of all very impressed that the learner communicated exactly what the source of the issue was. I think in a situation such as that, that I would call the team together and look at how we can create a support plan. I think he's effectively communicated that. Also looking at multiple ways of learning that would meet that particular student's needs. So are there ways that we can sometimes branch out from that teacher? Does he need to be confined to a particular classroom? I don't believe any student should be confined to the classroom. So would there be opportunities for learners to maybe do some work at the library or the computer lab or things such as that? And I don't want it to be just him being pulled out. And also, can the teacher potentially take a look at themselves? And you got to introduce that in a very sensitive way in terms of how we put that on the table and bring that up. And the way I'd probably do that is I'd look at maybe past examples of where there wasn't a match, maybe similar types of scenarios, and say, this is what worked, and can we all come to an agreement that we would try this particular approach in terms of, you know, being more sensitive and things such as that. I think perhaps that teacher might benefit from seeing a model of someone that doesn't make the student feel that particular way. And maybe I would potentially introduce some co-teaching with a special educator to kind of buffer some of the things that are taking place.
Okay. We only have a few more minutes, or time for a few more questions, I should say.
Okay.
Here's one from Nahida in Toronto, and she's asking, how can I teach a child who is 6 years old with autism the taking a shower skill?
Okay. I would almost have to, so this was like taking a shower at home?
Not a shower.
Or?
At home.
At home. I would, first of all, almost have to see that particular individual in terms of, you know, how we did personal hygiene in the past, what were the features that were positive about that they liked that, and how can we associate some of those positive features about personal hygiene with maybe taking the step with a shower. And also I would very much look at the way the individual learns the best and takes in new things the best. So whether it's a particular picture sequence that we talk about, I would say for certain individuals that was helpful, or a written sequence in some cases. And I definitely would use that thing that I've said a couple of times in the call, think big but start small. So how can we maybe introduce, first of all, some of the steps in terms of talking about that? What are some of the things that you're using? Having a little step-by-step, maybe we would say sequence with words and pictures, or maybe some supports, so that we're being really sensitive to the way that we're introducing that? And also, would there be some things that the individual likes that would be positive things that we could also associate with that experience?
Very good. Here's Juliet from Toronto, Canada. My autistic son is 14 years old, and he is learning at home with me well and with some therapists, too. But I always ask from the school how he's learning at school. They say he can't even identify alphabets, but at home he can do core work with me with no trouble. Is it
okay.
a true problem with autistic children, or is this an excuse from the school? Is it a problem with the child? Please let me know how to make him learn at school.
Yeah, I think, first of all, this has been put on the table, obviously, and I would be a big fan of potentially the school doing a home visit, or if that's not such a high priority, is could we find a way to film that and sit down together as a team and look at what are the features or learning techniques that are making that happen in one environment and maybe not in another environment, and how can we replicate that as much as possible in the environment where we may find some shortcomings are taking place. So I would say possibly a film that we discuss, or actually observing the particular learning in the setting that they are able to utilize that skill, and then talking about a plan for the team so we can make it happen in all environments.
Those are very good points. I've actually used those quite a few times, and they've been very helpful.
Yeah, I'm filming my cats right now because one is actually going to the bathroom in the basement that's not in the litter box. So there's a film taking place because I want to know, first of all, which one of the two is doing that, and then we'll go to the doctor and we'll find out if there's any urinary infections or things such as that. So my cats are being filmed right now.
I have to say the home visit, if the teacher is open, is really great. In fact, that was the first way that they even tried anything academic at school with my son. Is they, not the teacher that I mentioned before, but an earlier teacher came to the house, saw what I was doing at home, and then tried it at school, and she started having success, and that was the first time then they asked me to come in and do some training with the paraprofessionals working with my son. So.
That would definitely be my preferred way. I like the home visit first and foremost.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's policies or procedures or times or things like that that interfere. So I found the film way is another way of, I think, bridging that communication as well.
Okay, so I'm going to give you one comment and one question really quickly here from Joe Clarkson in Wellsville.
Okay.
And I'm going to ask you again to remind people the names of your books and your website.
Okay.
Here's a question comment from Joe Clarkson. I was wondering how much Patrick charges to go to schools and help students get included. I've heard Patrick speak before, and he is wonderful. I love his books. I'm very excited, and I can't wait till November 30th.
Why, thank you. That's really sweet. In terms of, like, charging, it's different, you know, versus, like, local, out-of-state, whether it's consulting, whether it's presenting, things such as that. So on my website, there are ways of contacting me to maybe specify what the particular need is, and then we could talk about what that would look like.
And can people contact you through your website?
Oh, absolutely. It's, again, it's patrickschwarz.com, and it's Patrick, and Schwarz is S-C-H-W-A-R-Z. And another one, I actually have a second address for it, and it's drpatrickschwarz.com. But don't worry about that one.
You want to make sure to spell the Schwarz part correctly because, unfortunately, I need to apologize publicly because I misspelled Dr. Schwartz's last name, I added a T. So please don't put a T at the end. It is PatrickSchwarz.
And it's German, and it means black.
Okay. And I want to remind them about your books, From Disability to Possibility, The Power of Inclusive Classrooms, You're Welcome, 30 Innovative Ideas for the Inclusive Classroom, and that was written with Dr. Paula Kluth. Another book, Just Give Him the Whale, and the latest book coming out, the children's book, is Pedro's Whale. And when do you foresee that one being published?
That will be coming out this spring, and there will be more next year as well.
Okay, and these, you can get more information on Dr. Schwartz's website. Now, before we leave, I did want to remind the listeners that if you would like to give feedback on tonight's webinar, you can call 877-211-0212 and press 1. We really love having your feedback, so I'm going to repeat that number, 877-211-0212 and press 1. And I would like to remind you about the next webinar, which is Wednesday, December 16th. The topic will be Autism and the Holidays, Lessening the Stress and the Expectations While Maximizing the Enjoyment, and my guest is Dr. Esther Hess. Dr. Schwartz, thank you so much for being our guest here this evening on MomsFightingAutism.com. I've really enjoyed having you here on this webinar.
Thank you. It's been an honor, and I really appreciate the compelling questions.
Yeah, we did have a lot of really good questions, and thank you so much for taking time out from your busy schedule to answer everyone's questions.
Thank you.
So everyone, hope to have you back here next month for the topic Autism and the Holidays. Until then, be the change that you want to see. Thank you.